Oh, and by the way, this is Reverend Scott.
I am indeed Reverend Scott.
Reverend Scott joins us today from the Accotink Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Burke, Virginia, and he also joins us from our home in Fairfax, Virginia. We are a married clergy couple serving two different congregations.
Yes, two very different congregations.
This one's much better.
That's another sermon, dear. In 1985, the Lutheran Bishop of Stockholm, Christer Stendahl, composed his three rules of religious understanding. First, when trying to understand another religion, you should ask the adherents of that religion about it, not its detractors. And then cross over into that tradition and with them as your guide, work to understand it as they see it. Number two, don't compare your best to their worst. And three, leave room for holy envy. And by holy envy, Stendahl meant that we should be willing to recognize elements in other religious traditions, elements we admire and wish might find greater scope in our own religious tradition. For instance, I have holy envy for many other traditions, like how Lakota Sioux will sing a prayer song asking forgiveness from their great spirit, Wakantanka, for taking the life of an animal that was killed for food, thanking the animal spirit. What do you feel holy envy for?
I watched a Hakka war dance last night on YouTube. This is the war dance of the Maori people. It is a fierce display of pride and strength and unity, and I find great beauty in it.
I have a holy envy for Viking ship burials. There's just something awesome about just gathering by the shore and sending, you know, your dearly departed back to the sea, which is where we all come from water.
I have a great reverence for the Quaker silent worship, where they invite the spirit within each person to speak when it is moved. Just sitting in a space quiet together for an hour of time, it's amazing.
And that's why they're called Quakers, because people start to move as they're filled with the spirit.
Yes.
I also love the old John Barleycorn beer rituals from ancient England. There's this whole set of rituals around the harvest and around the making of the beer and tasting it along the way to make sure it's brewing right.
Sure. Yeah. And I also love the Hindu practice of sacred chanting. The fact that the vibrations of the chants move through your body and move through everyone's bodies, sort of uniting us in a very powerful experience. I love that.
We've stepped into some of these practices, seen some of them from within, and it's how one develops holy envy. To do so, though, you have to cross borders, the borders between our tradition and those other ones, and the borders between the known and the unknown.
We're often called a border-crossing faith, Unitarian Universalism. We make the bridges that unite one person or one idea or one path to another. Think of the marriages that Unitarian Universalist ministers and congregations perform. Marriages between Jewish and Catholic, Muslim and Christian, atheist and believer, female and female, male and male, crossing borders. These marriages are perhaps the symbolic manifestation of our border crossing. Our faith tradition is a nexus point where differences converge, where people as different as Reverend Scott and I can meet and then go forward together. But we also struggle. We struggle just as much as anyone else at crossing borders. It's not easy. We don't have special border crossing powers, that pixie dust that allows us to float up like Peter Pan and go visit the Lost Boys. What we do is we build communities that we call congregations, where border crossing is lauded, is extolled from pulpits just like this, is examined in faith education classes and would be examined in faith education classes if there were any children here this morning, so that border crossing becomes something that we do. faithfully. It's part of our faith practice.
I'm a rock and roll musician, and when I was 19, I lost one of the best guitar players that I ever had to Jesus. My guitarist, Willie, called and said, "I found Jesus, and he told me to lose the band." So quickly I said, "Oh, Willie, I'm so happy you found faith in meeting. Can I come to church with you?" He said, "Of course." So that Saturday night, I entered this small collection of shacks not far from the entrance to the Edgewood Arsenal, northeast of Baltimore. And right after dinner, a Snake Revival preacher shouted holy harangues at us for about 2.5 hours. He passed out the snakes. I'm not kidding. And to those willing to risk it, he said, "They won't bite the righteous." I was saved by dessert. And then after the dessert came the midnight prayers. And if I may, Corinne. So 2 by 2, we sat on the floor in lotus position, this close. And my buddy Willie said to me, he said, "Now some strange things might happen. If I'm lucky, I'll be given the power to speak in tongues. But don't worry." So he starts to pray and nod, and you know, I'm thinking, do I really need a guitar player this bad? He was the star of the show, and he was the best singer in the band. And not long after, he began to speak in tongues. So a minute passed, and 5 minutes passed, and about an hour later, he came to, and he said, "I'm so glad to share this with you." He was sweaty. He was sweaty and somehow oddly recharged. It was about 1:15 in the a.m. And how I admired his conviction and his assurance, I had my own prayer that it would not take that kind of religion to save me. So I crossed that border, and that mattered. But I did not want to stay in that land.
So after 18 years in New England, I grew up in Connecticut, I chose a college in Tennessee. I won't go into why exactly, but I can promise you that I found both the courage and the passion that made that border crossing in my own Unitarian Universalist youth group. They challenged me to cross borders, and so that one was a pretty easy one I could take on. Once on that mountaintop in Tennessee, I met a culture as foreign to me as another nation, another faith. Those strange people, those Southerners, they called everyone ma'am and sir. Bob, you called me ma'am this morning, and I had a flashback. On Parents' Weekend, there were enough ma'ams and sirs to make my New England head spin. And it was at that first Parents' Weekend when I realized that I had to let go of my observer status and step into the fray. I had to meet my new friend's parents, and I couldn't rightly say, "Hey," or "Mm-hmm." I had to say, "Yes, ma'am," and "Yes, sir." When I was observing the practice, I imagined that it created this distance between the speakers. But once inside, it seemed to draw us into a ritual, into a space of reverence, one that I can even envy, a space that allowed us to speak more candidly. Who knew? So, sir, what have you got for us?
Well, about crossing borders, that's really what holy envy speaks to. It asks us to try and authentically experience other religious traditions, other religious elements, and see which ones we might admire, and to share these spiritual practices and orientations, wondering how might these improve my own faith, even be a good addition to Unitarian Universalism. I have holy envy for Salat, which is the Muslim command to pray 5 times a day. Think about it. Our modern life has so many distractions. You can't even get gasoline anymore without some moron on a TV at the pump trying to sell you stuff. I hate these things. Islam commands attention to something of a higher order, right? Asks for our submission to stay focused on what's ultimately most important. One scholar identified Islam to me as God is God and you are not. And the command to pray at regular intervals throughout the day helps us never forget that there's something more important than myself, my will, my desires, my commerce. We're always part and particle of something much larger than our individuality, and we forget it. Praying 5 times a day means we're never far from having just prayed, affirmed our dependence on something transcendent. Often the words are still in our tongues. And it means we are paying attention to nature, to the sunrise, the noon time, the sunset, to make sure we do our prayerful duty on time. So it connects us to nature as well as the divine. Salat means our smallness is ever present, our dependence ever proclaimed, and I just find that comforting and empowering.
I grew up my first few years in a faith community at a congregational church. They were not as enamored there as we are with change and originality. They liked constancy, a return every Sunday to the same rituals, the same melodious or mal-odious at times, hymns. Boredom did steal me at times. I have this memory of playing with the kneeler. I can still picture my tiny feet trying to reach the kneeler and put it down and put it up. So I know that I was bored to tears at times in those services.
Wait, you're fidgety too?
I was. I got over that. But I have holy envy for your fidgetiness. But when I said the Lord's Prayer in those church services, something about it changed and moved in me. Feeling the way that all the voices in that space married one another in this unity. We poured over the words. Perhaps what I felt was that collective embrace of what Reverend Scott calls God is God and I am not. That collective embrace of humility. The words, give us this day our daily bread and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And yes, we use the trespass version. That's what I grew up with. And as my voice fell in step with all the adults, I was learning something about forgiveness, something about fallibility and humility, something that my child mind couldn't fully follow yet, but something that was working its way within me. So that today, when I silently say to myself, and lead us not into temptation, I can stall myself from some action that could harm me or others. I still use that as a mantra. This simple prayer of humility, I have holy envy for this. We do not always ask for forgiveness in our Sunday rituals. I wonder why.
I too long for more rituals of forgiveness and confession. I often joke to the good folks at Akatink that I actually have blueprints for a confessional I'd like to build one day. One of the most powerful rituals of confession among the world's religions is the Ashmanu. It's a communal profession of guilt found in Judaism. And on some level, in this ritual, individual transgressions are acknowledged to have a communal component. So if someone does something terrible, yes, that person may be in pain, in error, or even yielding to desires or other selfish impulses like greed. But the Ashmanu, along with the Al Shet, both recited many times during Yom Kippur, these prayers remind us that we have all sinned. All are responsible for the condition of the communities we live in. The Ashmanu, particularly goes down a long list of sins, and they do this 10 times in the last service of Yom Kippur. We have been dishonest. We have broken promises. We have been stubborn. Everyone says it together out loud. It reminds us that if the society, the nation, produces sick individuals who do terrible things, even if we are not legally guilty, we must be part of the reparation. This prayer, done aloud in community, is another reminder that we are interdependent.
So, holy envy. Let me tell you what holy envy is not. It is not a Black Friday deal. We see something over there that looks really good, and so we stand all, you know, all night in line, and then we go get it. Holy envy, it's not borrowing of another's traditions because we think we deserve them or because we think we could do better with them. Holy envy is humility in the face of beauty. It's humility in the face of beauty. I said earlier that we are a border-crossing faith, but that we struggle with border-crossing just as much as anyone else. We do pretty well at revering the Buddhists' non-attachment, the Hindus' many gods even, the Muslims' constant prayers. But can we revere the Christians' forgiveness prayer? The story, perhaps, of the baby Jesus. Can we sing Silent Night and let its lilting phrases embrace us on Christmas Eve? Or will we cringe every time a word we don't believe in is spoken? The borders that are harder for us to cross are those that perhaps we have already had to cross. Those that perhaps we crossed as an escape from a tradition that did not love us in our fullness, or a border that we had to cross for greater freedoms. I still hear some denigrate Christianity, while in the same breath we uplift the world's religions. Christianity is a religion of the world. Maybe it's the religion of the world that some of us hail from, and that's why it's hardest to embrace it with holy envy. Of course, holy envy isn't enough. We still need to question, to doubt, even argue with the faith premises and conclusions. As a child, I was often awakened in the night to a loud, booming conversation down the stairs, and I would walk down the stairs, and I would say, "Mom, what's going on? What's happening?" And she would say, "Don't worry, honey, we're just having a Jewish conversation." Isaiah, the Hebrew prophet, paraphrases the Hebrew God as saying, "Let us argue together. Set forth your case that you may be proved right." I have holy envy for the tradition of argument, but not as an end in itself. Unchecked arguments carve chasms, tearing us from one another. There must also be room for holy envy. Do you hear me? After your Thanksgiving meal, do you hear me? Yeah. Mm.
So from Christianity, I have always envied the story of Jesus. I was raised Southern Baptist, so I had a lot of exposure to it. A simple babe born to poor parents, forced to be brought into this world in a barn and laid in a manger, a food trough, for goodness sake. And this humble person opens to spirit and becomes a threat to the palace and to the temple. I am blue collar, and the story of Jesus always spoke to me, telling me that even the son of people who work with their hands can turn this world on its head. Jesus' courage with the political and religious leaders of his day inspire me to courage, me to public witness and public ministry, to tell all that I meet, yes, you can change the world too. Opening up our vision of the beloved community, Jesus reminds us the Hebrew prophets foretold how to better order human society, reminded us that That religion, Judaism, tells us that we're responsible to take care of the poor, the widow, the orphan, the immigrant. The world should be more just than it is. Jesus' humble origins show that anyone with courage and vision can lead us to a more perfect union here, now, on this side of the grave, even if it may cost us our lives to bring it into being. I envy that sacrifice, that resolve, that vision and compassion.
So this is our challenge, and this is especially my challenge. This year when I pass a creche on a courthouse lawn, I will begin by questioning what is it in our nation's history that makes us think that it's okay to put a single religious symbol on a courthouse lawn. Mm. And I will struggle with that, and I will fight against it, because I believe we are a nation of pluralism. But I will also look at that creche, and I will see the beauty of the child in a manger struggling to change a world from the dirt to hope. I will see the beauty, and I will see the challenge. I will have holy envy and holy doubt.
So consider the world as it is, right? And then consider how it should be, how it could be. Share your vision of that beloved community, that more perfect and righteous world. And as we fashion this image of the kingdom come, let us share how we can bring that better world into being, but bring it into being with love and power, as well as courage and grace. And along the way, pay attention as you cross those borders, finding those things worthy of your holy envy, those things that you can bring back and fold into your life or into our common religious life. Because what the world is waiting for in this season of Advent is for us to come alive with courage and vision to fashion the world as we know it should be.
Amen.